And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Aram Gedzuzian back to the program today. Aram is a professor of history at the University of Memphis. He has written biographies of Sidney Poitier and Bill Russell, as well as an in-depth look at the civil rights landmark, the Meredith March Against Fear. Today we'll have the first of a two-part interview about his latest book, The Men in the Moment, The Election of 1968 and the Rise of Partisan Politics in America, which is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Aram, before we look at the people you write about in the book, I think we need to learn a little bit how presidential campaigns and the primaries were very different back in 1968.
In 1968, you're still operating under what some people refer to at the time as sort of the old politics, in which, you know, the party primaries weren't that significant. The most delegates for the national conventions were chosen through state conventions, in which it was, you know, sort of the old line party officials were the ones who were deciding who was going to be their nominee.
The smoke-filled rooms.
Exactly, the smoke-filled rooms. In some states, there was a favorite son was the term that was used, who would run. It was typically a governor or sometimes a senator who would run as the nominee, not because they were running for president, but mostly because they wanted to control those delegates at the convention, and then they would use that as sort of a political bargaining chip. In other states, there were primaries, but they served as what were known as beauty contests. They had no effect whatsoever on delegate selection at all. So only a handful of states had the system that we now know of as open primaries, in which the voters themselves would choose who would be the delegates who would support the party nominee at the national conventions for both the Democratic and the Republican parties.
And also, primary season has become much more compressed. Over half the primaries are decided within like a 6 or 7 week span. Mm-hmm. And back then, it went on through the summer.
Sure. And every state had its own way of doing things. They had different entry qualifications to get into the primary. In certain states, you had to apply by a certain date. Nebraska was a state that said if you were a primary candidate in any other state, you were automatically on the ballot in Nebraska. They each operated by the different rules. They were on entirely different calendars. New Hampshire was the first primary, and that was in February of 1968. And those primaries stretched until June of that year, just months before the conventions actually occurred.
Because Nixon didn't officially declare his seeking the presidency until, what, the 3rd of February in 1968? Beto O'Rourke gets chastised for waiting so long to declare, and it's not even anywhere close to.
Yeah, we're still a year out on most of those primaries now, and we've got a whole slate of candidates who are going to run, of course. And even on the Republican side, there are some people making noise about challenging President Trump.
Now, before the 1968 election season kicks off, which Republicans had made noise that they might be running?
In 1967, the person who appeared to be the front runner for the Republican Party was George Romney. He was the governor of the state of Michigan, and he had a reputation as something of a progressive Republican. He had a reputation for strong race relations in the state, for fostering a positive business climate. He was sort of that ideal moderate Republican that existed in the 1960s in the mold of people like Nelson Rockefeller, who was somewhat of a sponsor to George Romney. And people assumed that Romney, who was this very sort of vigorous and dynamic candidate in 1967, would emerge as the Republican frontrunner. But he was derailed by a few things. One of them was that Detroit got hit with a massive race riot in the summer of 1967. That, along with the riot in Newark that summer, focused a lot of attention on urban violence, on racism, and the very different ways in which Americans reacted to that. You know, some saying that we needed to do more to foster racial justice, while others clamored for what was known as law and order, right, that we needed to take a harsher line on this kind of violence. And Romney kind of got stuck in between, and he suffered a lot of criticism for that. Lyndon Johnson, who saw Romney as his great rival in 67, decided to wait until Romney actually delivered in writing a specific request for National Guard troops, basically admitting that he couldn't contain the violence himself rather than just simply send the National Guard when the violence broke out. He used this to embarrass a potential rival. And then Romney himself derailed his own nomination. He went into the New Hampshire primary thinking that he was going to be one of the front runners, but he just could never really establish momentum. He was sort of an earnest, plodding candidate, couldn't really connect with the people in any sort of effective way. Meanwhile, Richard Nixon, the other main competitor in early 1968 for the Republican nomination, ran a very smooth operation, one rooted in television appearances in particular. He aired a number of television commercials in which even, you know, there was no media around. He was really running a different kind of presidential campaign. He was really at the forefront in terms of how television was transforming politics. Rather than taking his case to the people and sort of doing the handshaking and the many, many events, Nixon would do one event every day designed to get on the evening news for that day and would make sure it was in a place where there was going to be a good crowd or it looked good on television. He ran a kind of political campaign that would show the way for the future in a way that Romney was running an old-fashioned campaign.
And he was playing to his strengths because he was not a personable slap-on-the-back kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, Richard Nixon, we forget now, but in 1967 and early 1968, he really had to shed the reputation as a loser, right? He was the one who, you know, the last campaigns that he had won had been when he was a congressman and a senator in the late 40s and early 1950s. And then he'd been Eisenhower's vice president in the 1950s. So he wasn't really carrying that ticket. When he ran for president in 1960, of course, he lost a very close election to John F. Kennedy. And then in 1962, he ran for the governor of California and again lost, which the reputation of Nixon was that he doesn't have the charisma, he doesn't have the power to really be a great winner in American politics. So what Nixon does in 1968 is in some ways the greatest comeback in American political history in the way that he sheds that reputation. It's very carefully crafted, very methodical, very well thought out path that takes him ultimately to the Oval Office.
What had his time in the wilderness been like between 62 and 68?
Mm-hmm. On the one hand, he withdrew formally from political office. He moved to New York City. He's originally from California, but he moves to New York City and gets a job with this prestigious law firm. That brings him some personal prosperity and a lot of business contacts in New York, which really sort of furthers his own sense of confidence and a sense of that he's sort of not so much an outsider in this elite world, which had been sort of a driving part of Nixon's personality. But he is also very careful to keep himself as a consensus candidate for the future for Republicans. What's happening in the mid-1960s with the Republican Party is that it seems to be splitting based on its conservative wing. In 1964, the nominee is Barry Goldwater, and he's running on a grassroots campaign that is really based on the conservative constituency within the Republican Party. And this can include people from the extremes, like from the John Birch Society, this far-right anti-communist organization, but also just a lot of sort of grassroots Republican operatives. It brings a lot of these people who resented the elites within the Republican Party, the people like Nelson Rockefeller, the people like George Romney, and wanted the party to adhere to sort of what they saw as classically conservative principles, a strong stance on the Cold War, fiscal restraint. But they were also seen by much of the country as extremists, especially when Goldwater got routed in 1964. He lost in a landslide to Lyndon Johnson. So many people assumed the future of the party was going to lie in the moderate Republicans, in people like George Romney. Nixon is always trying to craft himself as a person who Republicans on both sides will be okay with, and he also builds up a lot of personal loyalties. In 1964, unlike a lot of other Republicans, he doesn't repudiate Goldwater. He campaigns for them. And then in 1966, he is an energetic campaigner for a large number of congressmen and senators running in the midterm elections. And in 1966, the Republicans win back a lot of seats in Congress. That's very successful for the party. And Nixon sort of establishes a lot of personal favors from all these congressmen. Those are the kinds of people who are going to help to select the delegates in the 1968 Republican National Convention. So he's building this loyalty within the party. He supports both the moderates and the conservatives. He positions himself between the two and is achieving the sort of political balancing act that no other Republican is really able to pull off in 68. And that sort of helps to bring up almost an air of inevitability to Nixon's campaign in 68. No one is excited about Richard Nixon as the candidate for the Republican Party. No Republicans are sort of thrilled that this is our guy, but he's acceptable to everyone.
So why did Nelson Rockefeller decide to get into the race?
So yeah, Nelson Rockefeller is sort of the leading progressive or moderate Republican of his era. He's been at this point, he's won a third term as governor of New York. He's done all these sort of great achievements in the state of New York in terms of building up the university system, in terms of medical plan for the state. And he's sort of an energetic, can-do sort of candidate. Many people assume that Rockefeller would be worried to be the nominee for the Republican Party would win in the general election because he has this sort of great cross-party appeal. And he supports Romney in 67 because he doesn't want to go through another bruising campaign. He ran in 64 against Goldwater and lost. He also – there was a lot of personal animus against Rockefeller among many Republicans. They said he's not conservative enough. Also, what got sort of dragged into the political arena was that Rockefeller left his wife for a married woman. He married the new woman, and so his divorce and his remarriage got sort of trotted out into the public arena. So for all those reasons, Rockefeller decided that he wasn't going to run for president. In early 68, as Romney's campaign is nosediving, there's a lot of pressure on Rockefeller to run. So Rockefeller schedules a big press conference in February of 1968 in New York. Many people assume he's going to use it as a big kickoff event. Instead, he deflates expectations. He says that he doesn't plan on running. But the pressure continues to build, right? If Nixon is the nominee, what's going to happen to this tradition of moderate Republicanism? And plus, Rockefeller, this is a man whose life is full of achievements, whose life is full of all these privileges. Of course, he's a billionaire, and he comes from this extremely wealthy and politically engaged family, and he can't resist the urge to run. So in April, he decides to throw his hat in the ring. By that point, it's too late to enter the primaries. So he can't challenge Richard Nixon in the six or seven primaries, which are relatively open. And then Nixon wins all of those primaries in a landslide over the course of the spring and summer of 1968. So what Rockefeller has to do is he has to convince the Republican delegates heading into the convention that summer that only he, among any Republican nominee, could actually win the general election. To do that, he runs a campaign that is really rooted in mass marketing, national television ads, local television ads, in over 500 full-page ads in maybe 50 newspapers around the country, just a media blitz. At the same time, he's traveling around the country. He's not campaigning in any particular state, but traveling around the country as much as he can and showcasing these big events, a ticker tape parade in New York City, riding on a steamboat in Louisville, Kentucky, a stagecoach ride in Idaho, all these sorts of cheesy events that are designed to, again, generate press coverage and get on the evening news. The third factor in all this is that Rockefeller wants the polls to show that he would be the preferable candidate for the majority of the American people. So polls are becoming not just a political a reflection of the politics of the time, but a tool that politicians use to advance their own agendas. It was really at the beginnings of this. So what he's trying to do is get Gallup and Harris, the two major polling agencies, to show heading into the Republican National Convention that he is the candidate who can win. And that way, what he hopes is that the delegates will see Nixon can't win. If he doesn't get a first ballot majority, we're going to swing all our votes to Rockefeller.
And as Rockefeller running as fairly liberal mm-hmm. on the Republican mm-hmm. side, Nixon setting himself as the moderate. Mm-hmm. And at the last minute, here comes the conservative wing with Ronald Reagan into the convention.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of times people forget that Ronald Reagan ran for president in 1968 because it wasn't a particularly public campaign. In fact, he didn't declare his campaign for the presidency until the Republican convention itself. Now, really, he had been sort of running an underground campaign up until that point. He'd been meeting with a lot of conservative groups, and he'd been in particular meeting with a lot of state Republican delegations. And he would say that he was going on a fundraising trip to raise money for the Republican National Committee. But really what he was doing was he was sort of showcasing himself as the true conservative, right? So if Nixon's the centrist, as you say, Rockefeller's to his left, Reagan is to the right. And Reagan is at this point something of a political neophyte. He'd only had any type of political reputation dating back to 1964 during Barry Goldwater's campaign. At this point, he's still an actor and a spokesman for General Electric. But he gives a nationally televised speech. It's a very effective speech in favor of the principles that support Barry Goldwater. And his political star starts to rise. He runs for governor of California in 1966 and wins. But he's only been in political office for 2 years when he declares for the presidency. And the idea, again, is, you know, whereas Rockefeller wants to show that, look, on a national level, I am the candidate who can do best among the American people, what Reagan's campaign is really built upon is going to the delegates themselves, who skew more conservative even than your average Republican, and say, look, I'm the one who best represents the views of the party. I'm the true conservative. I'm the one that you actually believe in. And he's winning the hearts of a lot of those Republican delegates. A lot of people love Reagan in 68 at the Republican National Convention. They really want to support him. The problem for many of them is that they had already pledged their votes to Nixon. He'd already sort of built up that political loyalty.
Strom Thurmond was running around.
Strom Thurmond was the key alliance for Nixon. Because he had Strom Thurmond on his side, the senator from South Carolina, and they had this sort of political relationship, Thurmond was the one going around reassuring especially the Southern delegations, I love Reagan too, but Nixon's our one, right? Nixon's the one who's going to win. Nixon is the one who can carry us forward. If it wasn't for that, that dam might have broke. A lot of Southern delegations who all subscribed to what was known as the unit rule, which meant that all of their delegates were going to vote for one candidate. A lot of those Southern delegations really flirted with Reagan, really thought about it, and they were Reagan was courting them hard during the convention. But ultimately, they stuck with Nixon. Both Reagan and Rockefeller were hoping that enough votes would leak away from Nixon where on the first ballot at the convention, Nixon wouldn't get a majority. If that doesn't happen, then sort of it all breaks loose and the delegates are sort of free to vote their conscience. And both Rockefeller and Reagan are hoping that the votes would drift toward them. Leading into the convention, everyone assumed that Rockefeller was the greatest threat to Nixon for this. In reality, Reagan was probably the much greater threat. Had Nixon not won the first ballot majority, and it was quite close, he won by just a little bit, probably Ronald Reagan would have ended up as the Republican nominee in 1968. But he just couldn't break through enough of those first ballot delegates to really do that.
Now, while he was eventually the Republican nominee, mm-hmm. he wasn't the most conservative person with a legitimate shot at winning some states, and that was the unconstructed racist then of George Wallace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so George Wallace is the big X factor in the in national politics in 1968. Remember, he's a Democrat. Most Southern whites leading up to the 1960s are Democrats. The Republican Party made some inroads with Dwight Eisenhower's candidacy in the mid-1950s. He was starting to build up a little bit of a Republican operation. But for the most part, for about a century, the South had essentially been a one-party region. And the South is in the midst of this political transition by the 1960s. Since the 1930s, it had held on to a somewhat odd coalition. African Americans increasingly voting for the Democratic Party, dating back to the New Deal in the 1930s. And then especially under Kennedy and Johnson, presidents who are seen as pro-civil rights, African Americans are voting heavily for the Democratic Party. Southern whites had historically been part of that Democratic coalition, but they're starting to defect. By the 1960s. And race, civil rights is really at the heart of it as much as anything else. So what we're seeing in the course of the 1960s is this ideological realignment where both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, had both liberal and conservative wings. As this shakes out by the 1970s, particularly by the 1980s, the Democrats are the liberal party and the Republicans are the conservative party. A lot of those forces are set in motion in 1968. Back to George Wallace. So Wallace, he's the governor of Alabama. He wins in 1962 on the platform that he makes famous in his inaugural address of segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. As you say, an unreconstructed racist. In 1964, he enters a few Democratic primaries and does surprisingly well in them in the North, in Maryland, Indiana, Wisconsin. So Wallace, by 1968, is running for president. He has national political ambition. And he decides to run as an independent. And the reason he decides to run as an independent is because he figures that that's going to be the best way that he can broker his own political power. He knows that he's not going to win the presidential election in 1968. What he seeks to do is to bleed enough electoral votes from both the Democrats and the Republicans that no one wins a majority. In that case, according to the Constitution, the election goes to the House of Representatives. And then Wallace's Electoral College votes become the key negotiating ploy, right? He can court favor from both parties and throw his support to whichever party is willing to make concessions to Wallace's platform. This in particular would involve slowing down desegregation in the South. It would involve social programs that benefited Southern states. And it was essentially a conservative platform. So Wallace is coming out of this tradition of the conservative Democrats, but the party that he's going to influence the most going forward is the Republican Party. Wallace runs this independent campaign. It's a grassroots affair from the beginning. In the 1960s, particularly by 1968, there's all this talk about the new politics, the idea of candidates who are bypassing the smoke-filled rooms and the old party machinery, taking their case straight to the people. And we see Eugene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy do that on the Democratic side. We see Nelson Rockefeller do it in his own way on the Republican side. But no one practices the new politics, ironically, better than George Wallace. It's a campaign funded by people. He has big money donors, but he's also getting tons of small donations. He's finding that white, disaffected voter, more often male than female, more often working class than middle class, and not just in the South. Wallace is taking where he's finding a fertile base for his politics is particularly in the industrial North, where you have a lot of white workers who are disenchanted with civil rights legislation, who fear inflation, who fear like their own status is eroding, and see Wallace as a candidate who represents their interests, who represents the little man, as Wallace calls him. He talks less in overtly racist terms than he did before. He talks a lot about the federal government, about bureaucrats, about liberal intellectuals. Those become sort of his main targets.
Professors.
professors. And race becomes sort of the submerged subtext there, right? And it's a successful campaign in the sense that it generates tons of national attention. It's relatively sort of under the radar through the spring of 1968. In fact, Wallace has to halt his campaign for a while because his wife, Lurline Wallace, who was the governor of Alabama, she had replaced him as the governor of Alabama, passes away in that spring from uterine cancer. But then His poll numbers start to rise in August and particularly September of 1968, just months out from the election. He's creeping up on Hubert Humphrey's poll numbers. The Democrats are tanking, and Wallace is winning a lot of those votes. And particularly he's winning the votes of union workers who traditionally voted Democratic in the North, who are now seem to be moving over to Wallace. And while his campaign somewhat derails by October, Humphrey starts to make a comeback. Labor unions leadership makes a huge push for them to vote Democratic as opposed to vote for Wallace. And Wallace also selects a vice presidential candidate, Curtis LeMay, who's an absolute disaster. LeMay is a
loose cannon supreme.
Loose cannon supreme, right? He's famous for in his memoirs stating that we should, quote, bomb Vietnam back to the Stone Age. And he has no political skills whatsoever. He talks in his first press conference about the viability of nuclear war in Vietnam, which terrifies Americans of all political stripes.
You remember Barry Goldwater lost because of that, right?
You know, it helps to lead to this decline in Wallace's momentum by October. But Wallace nevertheless ends up winning five states in the Deep South. It's not enough to prevent Nixon from winning a majority in the Electoral College. But it does prove to be a significant factor, and particularly from that moment on, right, from 1968 on, Nixon is trying to find a way to win those Wallace voters for the Republican Party in 1972. And there's, you know, while Wallace is a Democrat, he ends up having much more influence on the types of voters that the Republican Party pursues going forward into the 1970s, and that's why he's more influential. Even though he's never been a Republican, he's exceptionally influential on the Republican Party.
And he adopts that dog whistle of law and order.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and Nixon's using the term law and order by 68. He almost never speaks out against Wallace himself, as opposed to the Democrats who attack Wallace because he's an easy target. Nixon wants those voters. And he knows he's not going to win Alabama. He knows he's not going to win Mississippi. But he thinks he can win Kentucky and Tennessee and Maryland and the so-called border states, right? And that's part of the reason why when Nixon chooses his vice president, he chooses the governor of Maryland, Spiro Agnew, who becomes kind of his attack dog, his own George Wallace, who echoes a lot of the rhetoric that Wallace does, who is very takes an aggressive stance, particularly against student radicals and anti-war protesters and black power advocates and all these sort of the people on the left that the sort of anxious middle class fears. So Agnew is able to serve as Nixon's way to co-opt a lot of those Wallace votes. And it ends up that Nixon does win the Upper South, and that is a key part of his constituency going forward.
Now, was it that threat of Wallace throwing the Electoral College to the House of Representatives that led Mo Udall and Charles Goodell to essentially what's the Interstate Popular Vote Compact mm-hmm. that's going around nowadays? Mm-hmm. They had a version of that back then.
Yeah. So, and it was developed by this professor named Gary Orfield, who was at the University of Virginia, a political science professor. And as you say, Goodell and Udall proposed this plan to Congress basically to say that whoever wins the popular vote, that's who the Electoral College should support, with the idea being that we're not going to let Wallace dictate to us in this way. The plan doesn't end up going anywhere, mostly because Wallace's campaign is faltering by as we lead up to Election Day. But had Wallace's momentum continued to rise in October and into early November of 68, you definitely could have seen some plan like that being used to try to cut off Wallace. Ironically, it probably would have served Wallace's interest in the sense that he could have said, look, these elites are stripping away your political voice, talking to his own constituency.
Because I remember in the 60s, there was even a big complaint against one man, one vote, because rural districts and states, especially like I remember in Arkansas, mm-hmm. rural districts had way more representation than urban districts did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And this continues to be a reason why rural voters continue to be so aggressively pursued, right? In terms of both presidential campaigns and on a state level, because of their sort of disproportionate representation. Yeah.
Of course, we're looking at this and seeing parallels between 2016 and 2020. Mm-hmm. But you see, with the riots that were happening in urban centers across America, paralleling with Black Lives Matters of the mm-hmm. past few years, mm-hmm. is that those on the conservative side only want to stamp down any expression of outrage while ignoring the root causes altogether.
Mm-hmm. And so a great example of this in 68 is the so-called Kerner Report. It was a government commission that Lyndon Johnson had appointed to investigate the causes of the 1967 riots. And Detroit and Newark were the two most prominent examples of this, but there were disturbances throughout the country in that year. And the Kerner Report comes up with this very ambitious slate of programs, basically that we need massive investment in the cities, that we need the root causes of violence are really rooted in poverty, lack of opportunity, and oppression. So the targets are often white-owned businesses and the police, right, which many African Americans see as the institutions that are hampering them. And so it's this ambitious report that comes out in early 1968. is basically ignored by President Johnson. He doesn't acknowledge it one way or the other for the most part because he reads it as an implicit criticism of his policy so far. And he knows he doesn't have the political capital in Congress to pass any of this legislation anyway. It's grasped onto by liberals. The Kerner Report comes sort of a blueprint for how to deal with what was known as the urban crisis at the time. But conservatives use it as a target, right? They say you're basically excusing people for violence. You're excusing people for rioting. The only way to stop riots is not by appeasing people, but by punishing them for the violence itself. And thus the term law and order becomes a key political term in 1968. The idea being that it's sort of a blanket way to handle black rioting, student radicals, anti-war protesters, all these groups that are taking to the streets from the left, right? And it becomes a way to demonize them. It becomes a way to say that they their concerns need to be addressed with force and with order rather than with appeasement and with going to their needs.
In our more recent history, it was surely okay for them to have Tea Party rallies. Mm-hmm. But Black Lives Matter rallies, that's beyond the pale.
Sure. So you definitely see a racial double standard in terms of this. And race is always sort of, you know, in American politics, of course, it's almost always been sort of this submerged and powerful tool for conservatives to sort of to stoke racial fears. And so you see that in 68, right? The conversation has changed in the sense that you can't be a George Wallace-style demagogue attacking on the basis of race, as he did in as governor of Alabama in 1963. But what you can do is talk about rioters. What you can do is talk about violence. What you can do is talk about radicals, all these people who hate America, and say that we need forced to deal with them. We need to build up our police force. We need to militarize our police. We need to punish people and put them in jail when they do these things. We need aggressive responses. It captures a certain emotional appeal among many white Americans, particularly those who are a little bit removed from the cities, particularly those in suburbs. One of the key phenomena of American politics that we see in post-World War II era is the increasing suburbanization of the United States, more and more people living in the suburbs. And that can create both pockets of liberalism, as we've seen in some places, but also these strong pockets of conservatism. Think of places like Orange County, California, or Cobb County in Georgia, the suburbs of Dallas or Houston. These become sort of the new hotbeds of American conservatism. And so particularly in the South, these become key organizing territory. And a lot of those voters by 1968 have anxieties, right? The Americans are by the standards of the world, are the most prosperous. The average American voter, so to speak, is the most prosperous citizen in world history. The United States has used the federal government since the 1930s to ensure all sorts of basic security, everything from Social Security to federally insured home mortgages to federally insured bank deposits, right? It's helped us to stimulate American prosperity in all these sorts of ways. But now that voter, that average American voter, the guy living in the suburbs, the guy sort of making it, who sees all these threats to what they perceive as their security. Creeping up inflation. They see civil rights legislation as favoring racial minorities at their expense, right, as if politics is a zero-sum game. And they see rioting in cities, and they see these spoiled college kids protesting the Vietnam War, and it stirs their anxieties. So in 1968, the voters that Richard Nixon is capturing are in a lot of ways voting their fears. They're voting their anxieties. And they see Nixon as sort of a steadying hand who's not going to be he's neither going to be a George Wallace nor a liberal coddler of these who threaten what they see as their well-being.
Well, Aram, we've only talked about half of the story mm-hmm. so far. Mm-hmm. Would you be willing to come back next week and we can discuss about the complete mess that was the Democratic primary?
Sounds great.
We'll talk next week.
And that's all the time we have for the first of our two-part interview with Dr. Aram Gutsuzian about his book, The Men in the Moment, The Election of 1968 and the Rise of Partisan Politics in America, which is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Please join us next time as we continue our discussion of this pivotal presidential election. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.